Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
So far, from what we've covered of Lee Harvey Oswald's time in New Orleans during the summer of 1963, we know that he worked at Riley Coffee Company, lived with his pregnant wife Marina and daughter June on Magazine Street, and renewed his passport to get one without any restrictions. In the last episode, we examined whether the apparently pro-Castro Oswald worked for or had a personal relationship with Guy Bannister, an ardent anti-communist who worked closely with Cuban exiles. Your answer to that question has a big impact on your overall view of the case. If Oswald did not know or work for Guy Bannister, then that supports the idea that his pro-Castro activism was genuine. On the other hand, if Oswald did have a personal relationship with Guy Bannister, it potentially supports the notion that Oswald's pro-Castro behavior may have been part of an intelligence operation. In this episode, we focus on Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee activities in New Orleans. How did he get started? Why did he get arrested? And what's the story behind Oswald being featured on a New Orleans radio station in support of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. Shortly before Oswald left Dallas for New Orleans in mid-April of 1963, he passed out Fair Play for Cuba Committee materials in Dallas. Oswald wrote an undated letter to the New York FPCC office that said, quote, "I stood yesterday for the first time in my life with a placard around my neck, passing out Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets, etc. I only had 15 or so. In 40 minutes, they were all gone. I was cursed as well as praised by some." Oswald then requested 40 or 50 more pamphlets from the organization. This letter from Oswald to the FPCC was first intercepted on behalf of the FBI by Dallas Postal Inspector and FBI informant Harry Holmes. Holmes learned about the letter because he was reading Oswald's outgoing mail. This FPCC leafletting incident in Dallas apparently really did happen because Oswald was also spotted handing the flyers out by Dallas police officer W.R. Finnegan. On May 13th, Oswald filled out a change of address order to send the mail that was addressed to him at P.O. Box 2915 in Dallas to be delivered to his new address at 4907 Magazine Street in New Orleans. On May 21st, Oswald received a letter from V.T. Lee of the New York FPCC with a copy of the current Fair Play for Cuba Committee literature. Oswald then responded to Lee on May 26th by requesting membership, a FPCC charter, and a photograph of Fidel Castro that was suitable for framing. On May 29th, the FPCC granted Oswald permission to start a new branch in New Orleans, but cautioned Oswald that, quote, "It would be hard to conceive of a chapter with as few members as is soon to exist in the New Orleans area. I have just gone through our files and find that Louisiana seems somewhat restricted for fair play activities." In other words, the FPCC main office was telling Oswald, "Good luck, buddy. New Orleans is not a nice place to hand out pro-Castro materials." Oswald did not wait for permission before he got started. On May 29th, the same day the New York FPCC letter was mailed, but before Oswald received that letter, Oswald placed an order for 1,000 copies of a 6x9 handbill that was printed by Jones Printing Company in New Orleans. The order was placed by a man who said his name was Osborne and who provided a handwritten rough draft of the flyer. This man, Osborne, picked up the 1,000 flyers and paid for them. While neither Silver nor Jones could identify this man as Lee Harvey Oswald, the location of the Jones print shop, which was across the street from the Riley Coffee Company, makes it clear that the person who placed this order and paid for it was either Oswald or someone who wanted to make it look like it was Oswald. During the first week of June, a Fair Play for Cuba handbill was found posted on a wall at Tulane University. The handbill listed A.J. Hiddell as the contact for the New Orleans FPCC, but the address on the Tulane flyers was wrong. It said P.O. Box 316, when Oswald actually had P.O. Box 361. These Tulane flyers marked the first public use of the name Hiddell, apparently by Lee Harvey Oswald. About a week later, around June 15th, a young man was seen handing out Fair Play for Cuba flyers at the Dumaine Street Wharf in New Orleans. This man approached patrolman Gerard Ray, who asked him to stop handing out the flyers without the permission of the Board of Commissioners. The FPCC activist eventually left, and Ray then reported these flyers to the FBI. After the assassination of President Kennedy, Ray told the FBI that Lee Harvey Oswald was the man that he saw handing out flyers at the Dumaine Street Wharf. The Dumaine Street flyers, for what it's worth, did not have any name or mailing address listed. Attorney Dean Andrews first met Lee Harvey Oswald in late May of 1963 when Oswald came to Andrews' office to see about getting his dishonorable discharge from the Marines cleared up. Andrews said that he could help Oswald and requested a $20 retainer, which Oswald never paid. But Oswald still continued to follow up with Andrews about the dishonorable discharge, visiting him between 3 and 5 times. He said Oswald also asked him about how to get citizenship for his wife, and Andrews then directed him to the immigration forms that he would need and told him that he could apply for Marina's citizenship without a lawyer. Sometime around July 10th, Dean Andrews walked outside of his office on Canal Street and saw Oswald handing out FPCC flyers. After recognizing him, Andrews then asked Oswald, quote, why he was handing out this junk. Oswald told Andrews that he was being paid $25 a day to pass out these leaflets. Andrews then reminded Oswald that he owed his law office $25. And that was the last time Dean Andrews said that he ever saw Lee Harvey Oswald. The Riley Coffee Company paid Oswald $1.50 per hour, which comes out to $12 a day for an 8-hour workday. If he was getting paid $25 a day to hand out these flyers, like Dean Andrews says, then that was double his pay at Riley Coffee. More importantly, if what Andrews told the Warren Commission is true, the question is, who was paying Oswald to hand out these leaflets, and for what purpose? On August 5th, 1963, Oswald walked into a Cuban general goods store called Casa Roca. The store was owned by Carlos Bringer, a 29-year-old Cuban lawyer who was living in exile in New Orleans. Bringer was the New Orleans delegate for the anti-Castro Cuban Revolutionary Student Directorate, also known as the DRE. Bringer reported on DRE activities to the local CIA office in New Orleans. When Oswald entered the Casa Roca store, he approached Bringer and asked him, quote, "Is this the Cuban exiles' headquarters?" Bringer said, quote, "He started to agree with my point of view and showed real interest in the fight against Castro. He told me that he was against Castro and was against communism." Oswald also told Bringer that he was in the Marines and he could help train Cubans to fight Castro, or that he himself would fight Castro if needed. Oswald returned to the store the next day and left his Marine Corps training manual as a showing of good faith. 3 days later, on August 9th, one of Bringer's associates let him know that Oswald, the Marine veteran who said he wanted to support the fight against Castro, was handing out leaflets on Canal Street in support of Castro. Bringer and other Cuban exiles confronted Oswald as he was handing out these leaflets. Bringer called Oswald a traitor, to which Oswald replied, quote, "Okay, Carlos, if you want to hit me, hit me." One of Bringer's friends, Kelso Hernandez, took the leaflets out of Oswald's hands and threw them up in the air. Shortly after that, police arrived and arrested Bringer and two other Cuban exiles, who were all able to leave on bail. They also arrested Lee Harvey Oswald, who stayed overnight in the New Orleans jail. On Saturday morning after his night in jail, Oswald spoke to New Orleans Police Lieutenant Francis Martello. Oswald falsely told Martello that the FPCC in New Orleans had 35 members and met regularly. After Martello was finished interviewing him, Oswald asked Martello to call the FBI and handed him a piece of paper with the number for the FBI. And Martello did as Oswald requested. He called the FBI, which resulted in Agent John Quigley going to the New Orleans police station to talk to Oswald. Before Quigley left the FBI office for the police station, he asked FBI clerk William Walter to find out if Oswald was an FBI informant. According to what Walter told the HSCA, Agent Quigley, quote, "asked me to check the indexes and determine whether or not there was any files or file on Lee Harvey Oswald in the New Orleans office. I recall searching the indexes and finding a card that showed more than one file number, which would indicate that we had more than one case." Walter continued, "From looking at the file numbers, they fell in the category of security type, informant type files." According to what Agent Quigley told the Warren Commission, he thought Oswald was making self-serving statements to defend why he was handing out these FPCC materials. Oswald told Quigley that he was distributing the FPCC leaflets, quote, "because of a patriotic duty as a patriotic American citizen. But more important than what Oswald said to Agent Quigley is what Oswald gave him, which was a pamphlet that Oswald had been handing out called The Crime Against Cuba. This was a 39-page document that was first written by activist Corliss Lamont after the Bay of Pigs invasion. The version that Oswald had was a first edition copy. If Oswald was handing these pamphlets out, he had to get them from somewhere. There was no home printer or word processor available in 1963, so that means Oswald either paid for and ordered the pamphlets, or that someone else gave him the pamphlets. Unlike the leaflets that were ordered by Osborne to the print shop across the street from where Oswald worked, we have no evidence that Oswald ever ordered or received the 39-page Corliss Lamont pamphlets. And even if Oswald wanted to order the pamphlets, he wouldn't have been able to do that because this pamphlet, The Crime Against Cuba, was a first edition which was available in June of 1961 when Oswald was still in the Soviet Union. By December of 1961, the pamphlet was on its fourth edition. So any pamphlets that Oswald would have ordered in 1963 would have to be the fourth edition. This usage of first edition pamphlets, which could not be printed, effectively proves that Oswald was given the pamphlets by someone else. Here's where the plot thickens. On July 29th, 1961, the Central Intelligence Agency sent an order to Basic Pamphlets Print Shop in New York and ordered 45 copies of the first edition of Corliss Lamont's The Crime Against Cuba, which were then sent to the CIA mailroom library in Washington, D.C. This seems too crazy to believe, but the receipt for this order has been declassified. Now, it doesn't prove that the CIA provided the pamphlet to Oswald, but it does show that the CIA certainly had the ability to provide the pamphlet to Oswald. And in the absence of any other reasonable explanation for how Oswald obtained a first edition version of the pamphlet in 1963, him getting it from the CIA seems like the most reasonable candidate. The pamphlet that Oswald gave to Agent Quigley also had the address 544 Camp Street stamped on it. As we discussed in the last episode, that's the second floor entrance to the building where Guy Bannister worked, and where at least six witnesses say that Bannister allowed Oswald to use an empty office. Jesse Corr, who worked at the International Trade Mart, got one of these first edition Corliss Lamont pamphlets from Oswald when he was handing them out on the street. Corr worked for Clay Shaw at the Trade Mart and was an FBI informant. On August 19th, he mailed the pamphlet to the New Orleans FBI. On the front of the pamphlet, Corr wrote, quote, "Note inside back cover. The inside back cover of this pamphlet is where the 544 Camp Street stamp was located." This correspondence from an FBI informant to the FBI, which advised the Bureau to take note of the back cover, appears to be a warning that Oswald could be linked back to 544 Camp Street because of this stamp. What other reason could there plausibly be for Corr to write "note inside back cover"? So, did this information ever reach the FBI? After the assassination, Harry Maynor, the special agent in charge of the New Orleans FBI office, wrote a memo to FBI HQ. A declassified draft version of this memo shows handwritten notes, which were scratched out, but are still visible. One of the notes that was scratched out said, quote, "Several Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets contained address 544 Camp Street. If the FBI is not concerned about 544 Camp Street, why then is Harry Mayner scratching out his note about it? And why is Jesse Corr bringing it to the attention of the FBI?
Hey everybody, Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount.
On August 12th, Oswald pled guilty and was fined $10 for disturbing the peace. After that, Oswald went to the New Orleans States-Item newspaper and asked reporter David Chandler to write a story about his arrest and his involvement with the FPCC. Chandler told Oswald that he would not write a story because he was not sympathetic to Oswald's pro-Castro viewpoint. 4 days later, on August 16th, Oswald approached 19-year-old Charles Steele outside of the Louisiana Employment Service and offered him $2 for 15 to 20 minutes of work distributing leaflets. Years later, Steele spoke to the HSCA about the incident, but he refused to tell HSCA investigators if he was aware of Oswald before he handed out the flyers with him, or whether he ever saw Oswald again. Declassified FBI files revealed that Charles Steele was an FBI informant known as T-14. This situation raises a few questions. What are the chances that Oswald picks a guy from the employment office to help him hand out flyers, and that guy ends up being an FBI informant? How could Oswald afford to pay someone if he was living solely on paltry unemployment checks? And what benefit would Oswald get from someone handing out flyers for just 15 or 20 minutes? The arguments about what is going on here come down to either, one, Oswald was completely crazy, and we can't effectively analyze his behavior because he was crazy, which is the Warren Report defender position, or two, that Oswald knew this incident would be filmed and he wanted someone to help him for a short period to make it look like the FPCC was bigger than it was for the cameras. As mentioned earlier, Jesse Corr was the informant who sent the pamphlet to the FBI noting the 544 Camp Street address. While Oswald and Steele handed out the leaflets in front of the International Trade Mart, Jesse Corr called the WDSU TV station and asked them to send a cameraman to film Oswald and Steele handing these pamphlets out. After handing out the FPCC flyers with Steele, Oswald was invited to be interviewed on WDSU TV and radio stations. Bill Stuckey was the host of a show called Latin Listening Post. Stuckey learned from his friend Carlos Bringer about the altercation that Bringer had with Oswald. Bringer also let Stuckey know where Oswald lived. On August 17th, Stuckey knocked on Oswald's door at 8 a.m. and invited Oswald to be on his radio show that night. Oswald agreed and gave Stuckey a 37-minute interview, which the station would not allow to be played in its entirety. Instead, they cut it up into smaller clips and played it on Stuckey's Latin Listening Post show. Believe it or not, Bill Stuckey was also an FBI informant. He immediately sent the 37-minute audio interview with Oswald to the FBI. On August 21st, Oswald was invited to appear on a live radio discussion on WDSU, as opposed to the taped interview that he had already given. The show was called Conversation Carte Blanche. The guests were Carlos Brignere and Bill Stuckey, both of whom were FBI informants, as well as Oswald and Ed Butler. Butler worked closely with the CIA as the director of the Information Council of the Americas, known as INCA, which was an anti-communist propaganda group. Butler also collaborated with Guy Bannister, Sergio Arcacha Smith, and CIA agent William Gaudette. Gaudette said that Ed Butler was the one who arranged for Oswald to be on Conversation Carte Blanche. During this radio show, Oswald apparently makes a small misstatement about his time in the Soviet Union, which he then corrects. Here's the clip.
For this reason, I'm curious to know just how you supported yourself during the 3 years that you lived in the Soviet Union. Did you have a government subsidy?
I will answer that question directly then, since you will not rest until you get your answer. I worked in Russia. I was under the protection of I was not under the protection of the American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen.
When I first heard this statement, I thought, this is nothing. Oswald simply misspoke and then corrected himself. Whether the statement that Oswald was under the protection of the American government is true or not, we don't know. But it's clear that Oswald retracted that statement and said that he was not under the protection of the American government in Russia. So, no big deal, right? When a transcript of this interview was included in the Warren Report volumes as Stuckey Exhibit 3, the transcript added the word, quote, not, to Oswald's statement so that it read, quote, I was not under the protection I was not under the protection of the American government. Since he corrected it, you can't really say that Oswald admitted to being under the protection of the American government. On the other hand, I cannot think of an explanation for why the transcriber went out of their way to insert a word that wasn't there and make it look like Oswald never misspoke at all. One would think that if all of this talk of Oswald being an intelligence agent was really nonsense, the government would let his misstatement speak for itself. But this tampering with the record suggests that someone was working hard to make sure that Oswald's words were not construed to be saying that he was under the protection of the American government. It's either that, or this is one more unexplainable coincidence. As we discussed earlier, Jesse Corr worked for Clay Shaw at the International Trade Mart and was an FBI informant. So was Carlos Brignere, the anti-Castro Cuban exile whom Oswald approached. So was Charles Steele, the guy Oswald paid to help him hand out flyers in front of the WDSU TV cameras. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. The other two Cubans who were with Brignere and Oswald when they were arrested were Miguel Cruz, no relation to Ted, and Kelso Hernandez. Cruz was FBI informant T2, and Hernandez was a CIA asset. Orvi Aucoin, the WDSU cameraman who filmed Oswald handing out the leaflets in front of the International Trade Mart, was also an FBI informant. Bill Stuckey, the radio host, was also an FBI informant. Look, I understand that there are a lot of FBI informants and CIA assets. And just because someone may have one of those titles, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing something nefarious. There could be innocent explanations. But when we have pretty much everyone involved with Oswald's arrest and subsequent filming of him handing out pamphlets and then going on the radio and TV, all being tied to the FBI or CIA in one way or another, it gives the appearance that Oswald handing the pamphlets out was merely a charade designed to capture video of Oswald that made him look like a pro-Castro sympathizer. From Oswald's perspective, this content could have been useful to help him infiltrate leftist groups. But the reality is that immediately after the assassination of President Kennedy, the films of Oswald defending Cuba on TV and him handing out these FPCC pamphlets were distributed around the world and weaponized to convict him in the court of public opinion. Those films, together with Oswald's time in the Soviet Union, made it look like Oswald was a pro-Castro communist, which would partially serve as Oswald's alleged motive for killing President Kennedy. The question we're trying to answer is whether Oswald's motives were straightforward or whether he was working on behalf of someone else. Between the amount of intelligence-connected people surrounding Oswald, the shady editing of the transcript for Oswald's appearance on the radio, Oswald's use of 544 Camp Street, Oswald telling Dean Andrews that he was being paid, Oswald paying someone else to help him, and Oswald's inexplicable possession of the first edition of the Crime Against Cuba pamphlet, we have to strongly consider the idea that Oswald was being set up and was working with others as opposed to being a pro-Castro lone nut. Next time on Solving JFK, we continue to analyze Lee Harvey Oswald's time in New Orleans with a focus on whether Oswald traveled to the rural Louisiana towns of Clinton and Jackson with David Ferry and Clay Shaw. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
Message data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.